I have achieved e-magazine nirvana.
Okay. What does that mean?
So we've spoken before, I think, about an app called Libby, which is an app for borrowing ebooks and audiobooks and magazines from your local library.
Oh, yes.
You log in, you put it with your library card, and it shows a catalogue of what's available from your library. And I use this to read magazines, because one of the things that you can do is subscribe to magazines from your library, and as they come out, it lets you borrow them in the app and read them.
Oh, you actually get to have them as they come out. It's not like just reading historical old magazines that you borrow like a book. It's actually like delivered to you like a newspaper would be.
Yeah, as they come out each month, it says, oh, there's a new issue of this published, and you can go and read that. And this is all very well and good. And Libby is quite good at the whole catalogue and subscriptions and notifications and downloading, but it's not actually that good as a reader. There's a couple of issues with it. The way it's built is it's basically a web app in a wrapper that then installs on your phone. If you actually go to libbyapp.com, you get exactly the same thing that you do by running it on the phone.
Right.
And the problem is that if you have it in the background for a while and then you go back to it, it restarts the web page essentially, and you get thrown back to the main page, which would be okay if it remembered where you were. Because if you then reopen the magazine that you were reading, you actually end up a few pages back from where you were, and it's not in reader mode, it's in the sort of PDF view. And the problem I have with that really is that when I want to read a bit of magazine on my phone, it's usually a sort of 5 minutes opportunistic moment where, you know, I've finished my breakfast, but it's not time for work yet, or, you know, I'm sitting on the sofa while my daughter's watching something on TV or something like that. And I want to just be able to very quickly, no friction, have a cheeky read while no one else is, you know, without disturbing anyone else.
You're not interested in Paw Patrol or whatever it is that's going on TV.
I've seen it so many times.
I was going to say, there's only so much in the night garden you can watch.
So I found a solution to this problem. And it comes in the form of everyone's favourite ebook Swiss Army knife do everything tool, Calibre, or Calibre if you prefer.
Calibre, yes.
And it turns out that there is a plugin called something like Libby eBooks, which basically pretends to be the Libby app. When you've logged into Libby on one device, you can then get it to generate a code for you to log in on another device without you actually having to have your library card. So you can use that to authenticate this plugin, which then does the whole catalog browsing, subscribing, downloading thing. And it does something that Libby doesn't do, which is let you download the reader view of a magazine as an EPUB.
Oh.
Which you can then read using another app.
Oh.
And there's something else that Calibre does, which I didn't know about, which is a function called the content server. So the content server does two things. First of all, it publishes your ebook catalog using a protocol called some combination of OPDNS, possibly in that order. That lets you read your books through other apps like FB Reader on Android. You can then add your collection as a network library. Or if you go to your computer where it's running, in your web browser, it actually gives you a pretty decent ebook reader running as a web page with everything you've got downloaded on that device available to read.
So to clarify, you sign up to Libby with your library card.
Yes.
You use Libby to subscribe to magazines.
Yes.
You generate a code, you go into Calibre and use this plugin to log into Libby. It can download your books, and at that point, that's great. But you're saying there's an additional thing where what? You upload your books to a content server? It's like uploading to Plex kind of stuff? How does that work?
Sort of. You press a button in the app on your desktop and it starts up a server on that machine that's running.
Right.
And then you can connect to that machine to either transfer your books into another app on another device, or you go there in a web browser and read directly.
So you could read from that machine remotely using whatever your favourite VPN is.
Yes.
Ah, clever. Okay.
Now, slight wrinkle in this is that it's a desktop app, and so you have to have a desktop running somewhere. And you can just run the server part on the command line, but then you've got no way of managing the books. And it's a bit simpler than you just suggested, because you can actually do all the subscribing and browsing the catalogue in the plugin. You don't have to do that in the app first and then transfer that in. So I found someone has created a Docker container, which exposes two things. First of all, the content server on the web interface, but it also runs the desktop app in a VNC session, which has a web client embedded.
Oh my God.
So you have two different ports exposed in this Docker client, one for the desktop to manage your ebook library and one for the content server to read your ebook library.
This sounds rather convoluted, I have to say.
Yeah. But you can also, you said, download the stuff as EPUB. And so Calibre can already talk to ebook readers. So you could send it to an ebook reader. And EPUB readers are 10 a penny. So you could just chuck them on your Android device or...
Yeah.
Right.
You could use any EPUB compatible app.
Right. This is just an extra bonus if you wanted to be able to access it anywhere and it be semi-automated, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Nice. So you've got an ebook reader now on your phone, because that's where you happen to be sat in front of the TV watching Paw Patrol in the background, but pretending not to by reading a magazine, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I have tried using actual like ebook reader, like e-ink devices in the past, but in this case, I kind of just want something that I can hold in one hand and just have in my pocket, which I've never found, even the smaller ebook readers, I've never found them particularly handy, if you like.
Yeah. I find them great for flights. And if I'm stuck somewhere, you know, like sitting waiting for a flight or something, then they're great. But I have real difficulty reading ebooks on a phone because I get totally distracted by notifications and everything else. And I also find the phone is too small for reading literally anything. I find myself zooming in and zooming out and moving around. And I went through a phase of getting a load of comics. I think I got them from Humble Bundle. And I haven't read them because I just haven't found a good way to read comics that will move from panel to panel and zoom in and out easily that isn't a super frustrating experience. Do you read any comics as well, or is it just like normal print magazines?
No, for that reason.
Right.
I thought about it a few times and then I thought I can literally not think of a good way of doing this. In fact, no, I can now think of a good way of doing it, which is sitting in front of this massive portrait monitor I've got on my desk, but I can't think of a way of doing it on the go that would be any good.
Or I could nerd snipe you and tell you there are apps specifically designed for reading comics.
Yeah, I had them on my BQM10 running Android many years ago. And I found them all hot garbage and I could not. I loaded up an M10. I think I was going to a company event at Canonical and I had my M10 repurposed from the Ubuntu phone days, put Android on it. And I just could not find a decent app. I had a load of them, even looked up, you know, top 10 comic book apps and all that and found them. And none of them were any good. I don't know if maybe our listeners can help me. But yeah, that's an aside for Mark's topic anyway. I have a Telegram on Asahi update for you.
Okay.
You may recall I mentioned back in episode 17, after Martin and I went to the Ubuntu summit in Latvia, I got so inspired to install Ubuntu, the Asahi version, on my M1 MacBook Air. And I did that and I reported in episode 17 about how successful this was and how happy I am with it. And I'm still happy with it. And I'm recording right now using my M1, using Linux. And I almost never boot into macOS now. I just don't bother. I leave it in Linux. So I'm very happy. And I did mention that there are some applications that are incompatible. They have ARM64 builds, but they don't work because the kernel page size is different on the Asahi kernel builds than it is on a traditional ARM64. I don't know why I say traditional ARM64, like literally any other ARM64 build has a different kernel page size. And the result of that is some binaries just crash or don't load. Now, for open source stuff, that's generally not a problem because I can compile it. For proprietary stuff, it is more of a problem. And I mentioned that I've been using some applications in the browser as a result, which is fine.
And the Asahi Linux team have got a table on their website where they're tracking the popular applications that do have kernel page size issues, and there's got a process of outreach, and there's sort of a burn down table of those organizations that have updated their packages to work on Asahi, and those that are in progress and those that are still outstanding, which is a pretty cool effort.
Yes. Unfortunately, there are some where the publishers of libraries that are used by some of those applications, some of them it's the same library that's at fault, should we say, or is to blame, or is the gotcha for that application. So it could be that there's a reusable library somewhere in one of those applications, or many of those applications in that list. And it's a bit disheartening because they've tried and the upstream isn't particularly interested. Now, I can kind of see why they're not interested in fixing it, because Linux is a 1%, and people running Asahi is like even 1% of that, if that, like probably much smaller. And so I took matters into my own hands. And as I mentioned in episode 17, I just build the Telegram binary on my laptop. And by building it on my laptop, it's built with the right kernel page size and the binary runs. So I'm happy. Well, I thought I would share this happiness with the world via the gift of making a snap. And so I thought, well, given that I know that the upstream Telegram developers publish the Telegram snap in the Snap Store, and it's called Telegram-desktop, I thought, why don't I just go and get their code and run Snapcraft on my local machine, and then I get a Telegram desktop that works. But I can't publish that in the store because they've already got the name. And so what I do is I clone their repository, and I check out the latest stable release. So I go and look at whatever the latest stable release of Telegram is, and I check out that revision. And then with a bit of ninja sed command lines, I change the name of the application from Telegram-desktop to Telegram-Asahi. And there's only like two or three lines that I need to change in the Snapcraft YAML. And then I use Snapcraft to build it. Now, it does take a long time. It takes an hour, hour and a half or something like that on my M1 Mac. Maybe if someone bought me an M2 or M3 Mac, I might be able to build it faster. That would be nice. But it's fine. And so I've done this a few times. I've been through this as the Telegram developers publish a new version. I have a little script that checks and lets me know when there's a new version of the upstream application, and I can build it. Now, I can't really do this in something like a GitHub Action, because it has to run on a machine. The build has to run on a machine that has the right kernel page size. And so I basically have to run it on my Mac, which is unfortunate, because that means I've got to turn my Mac on and, you know, run the script that builds it. Yeah, I could rent a Mac in the cloud, but I'm not going to do that, right? I'm not going to pay money for this. So I build it, and then I test it locally to make sure it works. And I've had to tweak a couple of times to fix something, but generally not much, because the whole point of this is their Snapcraft YAML works. They're already building the thing. All I'm doing is just rebuilding it. So in theory, it should work. And most of the time it does. And so I build it in the Snapcraft store. I registered the name Telegram-Asahi, and then I published it. And I put some screenshots in there, and I put the description in there, and I made sure the description shows that it's unofficial. And so this is just a thing that only really is useful for people on Asahi and is not really useful for anyone else. And now I install it from there. So I've got my script running to detect a new version, build it, publish it, I test it, and then if it works, I put it in the stable channel. And I've mentioned this a couple of times, but there's a very limited audience of people who would care about this. And actually, I know how big the audience that care about this is, because I could see how many people have installed it from the Snap Store, which is 16. There are 16 people using the Telegram.
16.
Yes, it is.
Isn't that the same as the kernel page size?
Yeah. So we're just broken into double digits of users of this snap. And that's fine. It doesn't matter how many people use it, because I'm really only doing it for myself and as a convenience to a few other people who happen to be running it. The thing that's interesting is most of the people are running Ubuntu Asahi, because it reports in the Snap Store, you know, what the OS is. But there's a few people running it on Fedora Asahi as well, which is great. I love the fact that there are people on other Asahi builds that are using it as well. And it's not a tremendous amount of work. You know, it's me running a script that runs for half an hour and a half and then shoves it in the store. the Telegram people are doing the vast majority of the work here. I'm just rebuilding it and pushing it into the store. And I find it a fulfilling thing because I'm doing something helpful and there are a dozen or so people who are also finding it helpful.
So you said you operate on a fork of the packaging, the Snapcraft packaging for mm-hmm. Telegram proper. And I think you said you just changed the name. So it builds from their source without any other patches, or do you have to change the page size?
I don't have to do anything. I just literally change the name. That's it.
Okay.
Because by virtue of it building on my machine, it builds a binary that works on my machine. I don't know if that's because like GCC and everything else is built correctly or whatever it is, that all the build chain works. And so that's all I have to do is just change the name. So all it does is the little script goes to look at what's the version published in the store under the Telegram desktop name. So for example, today, the version published in the store, the official version is 4.14.4. And so I clone that repository, the upstream Telegram desktop repository, ninja the name, and then build it, publish it. There's since then, as we're recording today, two new releases came out today, 4.14.5 and 4.14.6. One of them came out 3 hours ago and one of them came out 30 minutes ago. So I guess there was a bug found that was important.
I hope you're not building as we record this.
No, I only noticed as I was preparing for while we were recording this. And I could have, because this is a very fast laptop. And also, it has no fan. The M1 has no fan. So you wouldn't have heard any noise or anything. That's the other compelling reason why I like building it. It just sits there silently building in the background. But what it does do is it pegs all the cores at 100%. And so there's no way I would have gotten a reliable audio recording while talking to you guys in a video call as well. So no, I'm not building it, but I will start building it immediately after. I'll skip the 0.5 and go straight to the 0.6, test that, and then publish it.
And are you going to speak to Upstream and see if they can produce a compatible build authoritatively?
No, that's somebody else. Somebody else has already done that, and it's another one of these dependent upon another library, and so there's not a lot I can do. Someone's already done that, and okay. I don't want to hassle them because they've got enough to do, and this is a tiny market.
I too was seduced by Asahi Linux when I was with Alan in Riga, and I have got a MacBook M2 now. Mm. And as a result of getting to grips with macOS and Asahi, I have found a project called Lima, which is a contraction of Linux machines, and it's kind of wonderful.
What is it?
So you could think of it as WSL, but for macOS. But it also runs on Linux. So its origins are interesting, but it has a sort of a killer feature, which I'll get to. So it started out as a way to have macOS have a WSL-like experience where you can just say, give me a Linux. So you run Lima and say, give me Ubuntu, and it drops in at the requested Ubuntu release on your machine and automatically mounts your home directory from your Mac inside the machine it created and automatically deals with the networking and the port forwarding, and you're just in an Ubuntu system and off you jolly well go. And it was really created to promote the use of Containerd and Nerd Control and things like that. So it was a means to sort of bring seamless container orchestration for local development stuff to people running macOS. But it also runs on Linux, and I think all the BSDs, I'm not sure if all the BSDs are packaged, but I know that the BSDs are referenced as well.
What type of virtual thing is it? Is it like QEMU? Is it like lightweight container like LexD? What's underneath the hood?
So it is QEMU under the hood.
Oh.
And this is going to be very important for later on. So the reason that I found it is that what I was doing is I moved my Nix configuration over to macOS so I could have the same user space and developer experience on macOS as I have on my Linux workstations. And I needed to make some accommodations for some applications that are just not published for macOS, or Darwin in this case is the name that's used for sort of the macOS user space. And so I was changing things around. And in that process, I found Lima. And what I wanted to use it for was this, was to create my Ubuntu build machines, which I create as virtual machines, because I'm on NixOS, and if I want to build something on Ubuntu, I obviously need an Ubuntu machine. And the way my build scripts work is they actually spawn containers to do the builds inside clean containers. So I want a VM of Ubuntu to then be able to orchestrate the containers inside it. And this is exactly what Lima is designed to do. And it integrates with CloudInit and all of the container runtimes. So it's great for this. And it meant that I could have my Ubuntu machine on macOS. And this is where that question about what does it use under the hood really pays dividends. Because the way that Lima is packaged and made available, they have a version, a current version, of QEMU bundled alongside Lima. And what's interesting about this QEMU that they ship is that it is a signed version of QEMU with the Rosetta support as a signed enabled feature. So what that means is if you've got an Apple Silicon device, you can create x86 containers and operate on those containers with all of the acceleration enabled, so you get fast, for example, builds. So this kind of segues with Alan's topic here about building software on Linux running on Asahi. Because what I'm now able to do is if I'm on Darwin, I can create my Ubuntu machines and still do my x86 build work when I'm running macOS without too much penalty in terms of, you know, the overhead for sort of synthetically emulating the processor architectures and stuff like that.
I mean, it is still synthetically emulating the architectures. It's just doing it rather quickly,
right,
and in a, you know, a decent way.
Yeah.
Right. Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Rather than having the software interpretation via QEMU, it uses the SoC features on the Apple Silicon.
So has this replaced QuickEMU for you?
Yes, sort of. So almost exclusively. It makes me wish I'd thought of this. So for everything that I do that's like build machine related, I'm no longer using QuickEMU. I just use Lima. And in fact, what I've learned, a trick that I've learned, is if you create a function in Fish, the Fish shell, and you put that into your functions directory, if the function name, the file name, is the same as the function inside it, it exposes it like a command or an alias to the shell.
Mm-hmm.
So you can create these fish functions that are basically scripts. So I've created some Lima scripts, some aliases, if you like, and it automatically stands up and creates and configures my Ubuntu build machine. So it's the right version of Ubuntu. It has the right build tools installed. It has apt-cacher-ng installed and configured, and that proxy exposed to the containers that run with inside that virtual machine. And so I can very quickly just destroy and recreate my Ubuntu build machines and do all of my development work. And that's great. And where Lima sort of stops is it really doesn't at the moment have any serious support for desktop style use.
Right.
But that's coming. So I think in the not too distant future, it will completely replace QuickEMU for me.
One of the things that I like about LexD is it's super fast to spin up a machine and it caches the images on the local machine. So if I spin up a 2004 image, it will go and get the image first and then spin up a machine. And then the next time I do it, it's all cached locally and it's all super fast. Does Lima do similar kind of stuff?
Exactly. Just like that. Yeah.
Right. Where does it get the images from?
It gets them from the container. There's a place where the distro, so
the internet,
Fedora and Ubuntu. Right. Yeah. There's a place where, you know, Ulma, all of the big distros, they contribute to this JSON archive of this is our latest image and here's right. all the signatures and what have you. And it consumes that and downloads them.
Nice.
Yeah. It's really very good. It's become very popular, this Lima thing. It's sort of integrated into a bunch of popular things, including Rancher Desktop and Podman. And I'm really not making much use of all of the container primitives that it has bundled inside it, although that is very cool stuff. But what I really liked was this ability to bridge between macOS and Linux on a Mac and bringing a consistent build environment with me. And it's also enabled me, when I was working on some of my little projects recently, to do test builds on different architectures very trivially. And the inverse is true. On Linux, I can create ARM64 containers and build for ARM on my Intel machines as well. So if you are working in an environment where you're building to multiple architectures, it's a really useful tool, and you can forget all of the WSL and container stuff. It's just a really great little lightweight VM manipulation tool that gives you tons of control.